sort your head out. Mental health without all the bollards. Not the actual word, but there you go. Sam Delaney was Jack the Lad. Confident, funny, an absolute legend, to be honest. Or at least that's what he thought he was. But when he reached his 30s, his relationships, his work, and his fatherhood started to take their toll. He felt like a complete failure whose life was out of control, and he turned to all the usual bits and pieces that you tend to. And as the saying goes, and I love this bit, he thought self-help was for hippies, sobriety was for weirdos, and therapy was for neurotics. It is a fresh and entertaining, but hard-hitting look at how to sort your head out. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Sam Delaney. Sam, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
No, it's a Monday morning. My head's pretty much sorted out. Just send me a bit of background then, because it's a difficult age, isn't it? You suddenly go from being that sort of like, here we go, nothing can break me, I'm invincible, it's all a bit of a laugh, and then suddenly you hit 30 around that and the world comes crashing and a lot of people can't deal with it.
Yeah, and I didn't see it coming. I kind of thought everything in my life seemed to be on track. I was in a very happy marriage. Had a couple of kids, my career was going very well. Everything seemed on track, really. So I thought I had nothing to worry about. I'd always been a social drinker. I was never one of the worst amongst my kind of peers at all. I always say I wasn't even in the, never mind Champions League places, I wasn't even in the Europa League places amongst my mates when it came to drinking. But as I hit sort of my late 30s, there was just so much sort of mounting pressure that I'd kind of that I thought I could handle and couldn't. Career, family, maintaining a certain sort of persona in my social life, it's a lot. And because everyone seems to just be getting on with it, I thought I ought to as well. But secretly, there was a huge amount of stress that led to me starting to really buckle under the strain and the overwhelm a little bit. But back in those days, we're going back 8 years now when this started to sort of take hold, I was just really ashamed. I thought I was the only person feeling this way. I thought, what a loser. And I really thought, who am I to complain? I've got a nice life. I can't complain about feeling depressed or anxious or anything like that. And because I was too ashamed to open up, and because my sort of Jack the Lad persona kind of, you know, discouraged me from ever showing vulnerability, to be honest, I just started to self-medicate. I couldn't cope. And I started to drink and use recreational drugs, just as a way of coping and numbing out the sort of bad feelings that I had. And now, of course, that's a half-decent, very short-term solution, but an absolutely disastrous medium to long-term one. All of my problems became worse. And what had been a situation that I could have managed had I been more open and honest and asked for help became, you know, a borderline crisis. And that built up to a stage at which really, I was driven to ask for help only out of a state of desperation because I realized my drinking was out of control. I tried and failed to cut down on numerous occasions. And in the end, I was actually desperate because I could see a future in which all the things that mattered to me, like principally my wife, my kids, my family, just disappearing. So I reached out for help and my life changed ever since.
Yeah, but the thing is, you see, when you go down that road, you know that something's wrong. You know that something isn't fitting, isn't quite right, and you're an intelligent person, but you can't get that last piece of the puzzle. So you find yourself asking, "What? I know what I've got. I know I should be grateful. So why on the proverbial, am I doing this to myself?"
That's exactly it. And I think really, in short, I mean, as you know, it's like a complex path you go on. The first step for me was getting sober. And then in the sort of 7.5 years that have followed, I've kind of done a lot of like reflecting, learning about myself. One of the most interesting things that someone ever said to me was the point at which you start using alcohol or recreational drugs to cope with your moods and numb out pain and you use this distraction is the point at which you almost stop developing emotionally. Yeah. Because you don't really need to. You don't find or develop ways of dealing with the inevitable ups and downs of life. You turn to a drink. Or in my case, it would have been a spliff as well. When I was like an adolescent, you know, me and my mates, and I think this is the same for most lads of my generation, we were starting doing that stuff down the park, down the rec when we were 13 years old. So I pretty much switched off from developing many, like maturing emotionally from 13. Suddenly I'm 40, I've knocked it all on the head, and I had a lot of learning to do. But it was fantastic that I had all that learning to do, because that you start learning to deal with the stresses, the strains, the challenges of life in a more sustainable way that makes life happier and more enjoyable. But yeah, that's what it's all about. It's about acknowledging the stuff you're going through and dealing with it in a sensible and mature way, and not just getting drunk and trying to forget your problems.
But you see, the thing is, that's the image of how we look at, how we view ourselves as males, isn't it? That whole down the pub, I'm all right, don't worry about that. You think, you know, I mean, you know, I think I've got a drinking problem. Okay, let's go and have a drink and talk about it. You know, I mean, it's that sort of situation, you know? Oh no, you're just a bit of a party boy, don't worry about it. And, you know, I'm just a bit of a hellraiser. And you get sucked into the image.
And you really do.
And the problem is that we are, like it or lump it, we're three dimensional characters. And you know, being off your nut half the time is a two dimensional way of looking at life.
Yeah, I always look back on myself back in those days and think, oh, I was approaching life in a very unimaginative way, because I only really had one idea about how to have fun, and it was to just pour drink into my body, right? And it's like, I didn't really do that much interesting stuff in my life because everything revolved around drink. You know, my work revolved around drink. At the weekends, I would go to football and socialize, but that was really just about drinking. I would play football, and that was really about end the five-a-side match and hit the pub. Very boring and unimaginative. And you're right, I did sort of marry myself to a persona, which is common to a lot of men of our generation, of being Jack the Lad, which is not so much about being tough and strong. It's more about being a laugh, not taking anything seriously. And crucially, not really even taking yourself seriously, because you think that's a little bit pretentious. So you don't want to take yourself seriously. That means you don't want to reflect on your own feelings. You think, oh, that can all be forgotten about. Just like you say, go down the pub, have a laugh. That solves everything. Unfortunately, it took me to 40 to think, actually, it doesn't solve everything. And there's much more to life than this.
When I speak to people who have turned their lives around, and, you know, and here comes the American voice, there's a moment of clarity. There's a moment where you say, I can't do this anymore. And I reached out for help. Does it have to be, you know, a crashing? Because, I mean, I've spoken to people and it's, you know, crashed cars, you know, ended up in hospital, you know, had bits and pieces pumped or stuck in them. Or was it just, was there a car crash moment for you? Or was it just a gradual realization and going, you know, like, I just don't want to do this anymore?
No, there wasn't a car crash moment, but in a weird, perverse way, I was hoping for one, because I was stuck in a sort of purgatory where I was holding together. They call it functioning alcoholic, I suppose. It's like I was holding together my career, just about. My marriage, although my wife had started to express deep concerns about my drinking, I had yet to reach that point where it was, you know, I was managing to be a father. I was managing to be a husband. I was just managing to preserve my career. But I mean, you know, was I anywhere near the best I could be at any of those things? No, but I just couldn't kick the habit. And I kind of wanted there to be a crash, because that's what you think. You think you need to hit a rock bottom, and then that will be the moment where I make my decision. There was a lot of small moments where I must say I wasn't particularly proud of my behavior in various different ways. And in the end, I went to see a therapist who was an expert in recovery, and she helped set me on the road to where I am now. And really, one of the reasons I've written this book is that I know there's blokes out there who will be feeling the same way. And I don't want them to have to reach a crisis before they seek to change their lives. I would like them to just, you know, I think prevention's better than cure. And why should we all wait to hit some undignified rock bottom before we start changing our life? That means, like, yeah, have a drink if you want, if you don't have a problem. But just, you know, treat yourself with a little bit more kindness and care.
Ah, oh, but you went to therapy, and that's a big scary word, isn't it? I mean, only Californians and A-listers and people go, I've been to therapy this week. There's a whole stigma about A, therapy, B, sobriety, etc. And people go, are you okay? And it's like, well, fair enough. So how did you approach your therapist? And I suppose it's a question of getting all your preconceptions blown out the water.
Well, I must say that I thought all of those things. I had all of those prejudices against not just therapists, but the sort of people who sought therapy, based exactly, you just described it perfectly. And because it was just so anti the kind of persona that I had and the culture I had, which was, let's not take anything seriously, anything can be shrugged off. So I must say that being kind of desperate, like lying awake one night practically in tears because I'd had another night on the lash, my wife was asleep next to me, my kids were asleep in the next room, And I just felt like, what, where is this going to end? This is terrible. I've tried and failed to stop or cut down a million and one times. And so I was at a desperate point. I was really like on the verge of tears. And I Googled like local sort of addiction therapy in the middle of the night. And I found a place that offered a free assessment. And I thought, well, what's the harm in it? But when I booked it in online, I still was 50-50 about whether I'd go. And I look at that, you talk about sliding doors moments. I remember the day when the appointment was there and I thought, well, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have lost anything, any money for not turning up, but it was almost on the flip of a coin. I thought, oh, I'll go up and see what happens. And the first conversation I had with this therapist was so different to what I'd expected. I'll tell you, one of the things that really disarmed me very quickly is that she swore almost as much as I did, right? And I thought, you've got this picture of Sigmund Freud, haven't you, on a couch saying, tell me about your mum and dad.
Childhood, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and it, like you think, oh, God, they're going to try and make out. And I haven't got anything decent to tell them because I wasn't the victim of abuse or any severe trauma, so it's just going to be embarrassing. It wasn't like that at all. She was understanding, but she was quite brutal as well in her sort of diagnosis. And sort of, she said to me, listen, I told her the truth about my drinking and drug taking. She went, listen, if you want to stop, which I think you should, I can help you do that. If you want to cut down, sorry, I can't help. You know, she was more or less saying, don't come back if you're trying to cut down, because I believe you're past that point. And so she gave me a really clear idea, and it was very sort of all or nothing. And I personally responded very well to an all or nothing sort of decision. I'm a man of extremes. A lot of addicts are. And so for me, throwing myself entirely into sobriety was a lot easier than all those like times I thought, well, maybe if I just only drink at the weekend, or maybe if I only drink after six, load of old rubbish. That never worked for me. The day she said, give up for good, I thought, oh, okay. And she said something else to me. I said, what about in the early days when I'm still craving a drink? She went, just remember, no one ever regretted not having a drink. And I thought about that for a while. I thought, oh, that's true. I've never woken up sober without a hangover and thought to myself, oh, I wish I'd had a few drinks last night. I feel so clear-headed and energized this morning.
Exactly.
I wish I'd just had a few. Nothing major, just a few. It's like no one ever feels that. You wake up having not drunk, you feel absolutely $1 million. 7.5 years down the line of sobriety, I still feel like that in the morning. You know, it's a great feeling. And as for all the stuff about you turn, you know, oh, it's weirdo and it's navel gazing. Yeah, I thought all of that. But, you know, I looked at the people I knew in my life who didn't drink but were still very funny, very sociable, tough. You know, blokes who I were impressed by, very often very successful and productive. And I looked at them and I thought, actually, they're still a really good laugh. And they'd still turn up at the pub and have a lemonade or whatever it is, a Heineken Zero. And you don't have to trade in your Jack the Lad card just because you get sober. You know, I do all the things, most of the things that I enjoyed doing when I still drank, I enjoy even more now. Best example being going to the football. Who knew that watching football matches is 10 times more enjoyable when you're sober and can concentrate? It's absolutely amazing. And all the other things. And there's a few things that I only did because they could only be fun if I was drinking and sober. They're absolutely rubbish and boring. So I just stopped doing them and found something more interesting to do instead.
But it's the big scary monster. Who knew that life could be so interesting when you don't run it with like 16 Heinekens inside you? Hey, who'd have thought that? Yeah, you know, yeah. I'm unbelievable. Yeah. But the way you and I like the way you say that quite a few of your illusions get busted, because you know a lot of people have these ideas. You're ones of therapists and psychoanalysts, the general publics of alcoholism. They think, oh well, if you're sitting in a park with, you know, with the raincoat and the bottle or whatever, then but if you're not doing that, you're not an alcoholic, you know, big false sign. Same with, you know, drug dependency. You know, if you're not sticking with a syringe out of any available vein, again, functioning, you've seen functioning because you've done it yourself. And I suppose it's the whole thing is that what you find is that what happens is your real mates stick with you, and the mates you went drinking with didn't just wanted you as a drinking buddy just fall away, and your real mates are happy that the real you is back rather than this cartoon character.
Yeah, you're absolutely 100% right. It's a natural filter. You may worry, oh, what will happen in my social life? And what happens is that you end up with the mates who are worth having. And the ones who disappear, you realize, yeah, they hung around with you because you were someone who facilitated their drinking and drug taking, because you made them feel okay about it, because you were doing it to the same extent. So you hung around with some people because, you know, you all made each other feel good, because you're all looking around thinking, well, we're all doing it, so none of us can have a problem because we're all at it and it's fine, and you all reassure each other. There are other mates. I've got mates who still drink. I've got mates who I go out with, and to be honest, sometimes I go out and I'm having a non-alcohol beer or a coffee and they still get really drunk. And I just know when to go home. You know, it's when they start repeating the story for the second, third time, I go home. And they've got no problem with that at all. They've never really commented on my sobriety. They don't really seem bothered. The relationships we have easily survived. And if anything, they've just become more meaningful. And I find other things to do with them other than going to the pub. And we tend to have more meaningful and interesting conversations. But crucially, we still have a laugh. Mm. That's the thing. You still have a really good laugh. I would say a better laugh sober than you do drunk.
What about family life then? Say, if it's not a personal question, but I mean, presumably... There was this turnaround. I mean, A, you lose loads of weight because you're not putting sugar into your body. Yeah. Maybe I told you about that one. You know, you get your feelings back, but hey, you get your feelings back. So it's, you know, it is... The thing about recovery, it's not easy. If it was easy, everybody could do it. You go, okay, right, I'm giving up. But it's hard work. I almost swore then. It's hard work.
Yeah, it is hard because you give up, you stop pouring the drink into your body, but that's only really the first step. After that, you have to relearn all of the things, like I said before, about coping emotionally, all the stuff that you used to numb out with drink. You have to deal with all the stuff. Maybe some of the stuff is from your past, the little bits of insecurity or pain or whatever it was that was bothering you and maybe sometimes made you drink because it was easier to live that way. And that's tough, but it's also enjoyable. So it's hard because sometimes you have to face bad situations almost with what I call a naked mind, with nothing helping you. You just have to like take it, white knuckle it. But it's great because then you learn to do these things and then life is less intimidating because life always has its ups and downs for all of us. But when a bad situation comes along nowadays, I feel so much more able to take it on, deal with it and move on with my life. Family life is, of course, much better. My son, my daughter was, I guess, 7 when I stopped drinking. My son was only like 3, I think. And he has no recollection of me ever drinking. And in fact, I've been doing this publicity around the book and he's now 11. And he's looked at him and went, I knew that you used to drink. I didn't know it was this bad. And I said, well, yeah, thank God I quit before it got worse. And you guys would have been all too aware of having a drunk dad in the house. You know, luckily, I was never an aggressive or loud drunk. I was actually a bit of a secretive drinker. That was my style of drinking when it got bad. I would go and drink alone secretly when I wasn't with anyone. But, you know, I look at my kids now, and to be honest, they're quite funny. They're seeing the stuff I've written in the book and some of the publicity I'm doing, and they're taking the mickey out of me for it, which is as it should be. I think that's a healthy relationship. They're taking the mickey about it. They say, oh, look, you've written this book, feel sorry for yourself and all of this stuff. And I go, yeah, whatever. But I'm just delighted that I have a fun relationship with them that is not, you know, and that when they talk to me, they know who I am. They know what my flaws are, but they can trust what I say. It's hard to really be trustworthy when you're drinking a lot, I think. It really is, to be reliable and trustworthy, which is what you really want to be for your kids. And in my case, for my wife as well. And that relationship has improved, you know, tenfold.
In the corner of my living room at my house, there's a window, and the sun is blocked out on that window by the huge pile of self-help books that people keep sending me. So, Russell Brand, stick it. Anyway, but so therefore, why did you decide that you wanted to write your particular book? Sort your head out, mental health without the bollards, not the actual word.
Yeah.
Because there are a million and one about your journey and your discovery to sobriety.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously just chatting to you, Sam, I know you've got a brilliant tale to tell, but it's actually getting that across without the psychobabble.
Yeah, that's it. That's 100% it. I wanted the book that I would have needed like 10 years ago, right? For all the reasons that you've actually explained really well today as well, Giles, is that I was the sort of bloke, I was a Jack the Lad, I'd grown up in a culture where you were deeply suspicious of anything to do with self-help, self-reflection, therapy, sobriety. And I think that all of those self-help books you've got probably all say a lot of similar stuff, right? and all of it is true and all of it works. But it might say it in a language and in a tone that a lot of blokes like me, can't relate to, right? So I'm a big believer in that we have to have as many different, we have to have as many conversations about this stuff in as many different ways as possible. Because what works for some people, like, you know, there's all these podcasts out there. What works for some people, like, you know, the Fern Cotton, can't remember what our podcast called, it's a fantastic mental health podcast, but it's not going to work for a lot of the blokes I go to football with who need to address their drinking or their depression or their anxiety, right? So they think, that's not for me. That's a load of old rubbish. What they're saying is true, but they're just saying it in a language and in a tone of voice that a lot of people can't relate to. I've written a book that I hope everyone can take something from, but in particular, blokes like me, lads who grew up in that beery, football-y culture, they might not be able to relate to some of the more kind of, like you say, the Californian hippy-dippy stuff that's out there. I've just basically reworded this stuff. I'm giving them the same lessons. I've not reinvented the wheel. I'm speaking it in my own language in a way that you and I have been speaking it this morning, you know?
And the thing is, this is an issue because this kills people. You know, I mean, it's, you know, so, you know, it is cunning, baffling, powerful and bloody patient. And so therefore, it's good that we're having these discussions because men didn't have these discussions, not even 8 years ago, not even 10 years ago. And now people say, oh, it's all gone woke. We're all looking after each other. And it's like, yeah, but this is, but surely, you know, unless you want people keeling over for heart attacks at 42, you know, or crashing cars or whatever, this is the way to go. So if somebody is struggling and we all struggle, you know, we're not all superhuman. You know, you've got to be able to talk about it. And if there is something that is damaging you and damaging your family and damaging your relationship, then to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, it's a horrible statistic, but it's true. Unfortunately, suicide remains the biggest killer of men in the UK under the age of 45. Right? It's rife, I think it's largely because men are ashamed to share their feelings, ashamed to ask for help. They think it's a sign of weakness. It's not. And as for the whole woke thing, which you do get some kind of old school blokes going, oh, yeah, I don't need to share my feelings. Why does everyone stop whinging? Listen, you know, the sort of blokes that I know and meet, and I'm sure you're the same, who are sober, you know, put them in a room with the likes of Piers Morgan and Jeremy Clarkson, right? Who are the guys who present themselves as tough. Well, I tell you what, you know, a lot of my sober mates go to football with me. I've been going to West Ham for the last 30 years, and a few of my mates there now have got sober. I'm not even in the top 2,000 hardest people there, but I tell you what, I'd knock out Piers Morgan or Jeremy Clarkson in the blink of an eye, mate. And I'll tell them I'm woke too.
I'm just thinking at the moment about how, you know, obviously you've conquered many things and you're a West Ham and you're a hammer too. I mean, that's just stacked against you, mate.
Hey? Imagine, I didn't tell you that bit. No. Now you know what the depths of the problem really was.
Brilliant. The book is called Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollards, not the real title. It's by Sam Delaney, who we've been to today. Sam, if people want to find you online, is there social media, is there a website, where can they find you?
I'm tweeting at Delaney Man. I have a Substack, which this book grew out of, actually, which you can find at samdelaney.substack.com. And you can find all the links and everything else on my website, which is samdelaney.co.uk.
And the book's going to be available as a virtual download from
on Thursday.
Thank you very much. Great. Oh, yeah, from Thursday on the TRE virtual bookstore. The book's called Sort Your Head Out. It's by Sam Delaney. Sam, thank you so much for your time today.
Giles, you're a great man. Thanks for your time.